Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Jessen, Judge Smith, the Honorable James Flory presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is June 10th today, 2021, and we have two matters on our oral calendar this morning. Even though we're appearing via Zoom today, as I'm sure you're aware, the rules of the court remain the same. You'll each be provided 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. Please identify yourselves for us at the beginning of your arguments, because we will record the proceedings and make those recordings available pursuant to our normal policies. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Daniel Gertz, appearing on behalf of Joel Wells. I want to start. There's a lot going on in this case. I want to break it down, and I want to start with the last two sentences in the district court's conclusory paragraph. The court said that respondent's conduct was either considered objectively reasonable under the circumstances or constitutes protected speech under the First Amendment. Because petitioner failed to meet the first element, this court need not evaluate the matter further. So we don't have the district court actually making a decision about whether harassment occurred, but I just want to step back a second. As you notice, the court employed what it thought were two elements of the harassment statute, the objectively unreasonable conduct on the part of the alleged harasser, the actor, and the objectively reasonable belief on the person being harassed. Those are not actually elements of this statute. You won't find them anywhere in the statutory language, and it just reveals a little bit about the flawed analysis of the district court.
Mr. Garrett, if I may, because I also was looking at that last part of the conclusion, and here's how I read that, and so tell me where you disagree with me. I read the district court, and we're looking at this under an abusive discretion standard, right? Saying, well, that these actions were objectively reasonable under the circumstances, to say, at least implicitly, well, then they weren't repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures. So isn't that just saying they're objectively reasonable, a way of saying, well, they don't meet this first part of the statutory definition of harassment?
Well, no, actually, Your Honor, that language comes from Dunham versus Rohr. That was a challenge to the constitutionality of the statute as being overbroad. The court there determined that, well, it distinguished it from the criminal statute that was found to be overbroad, and determined that no, this statute actually requires something more than the subjective belief of the person being harassed. It has to be objectively reasonable, and the conduct has to be objectively unreasonable. They're referring to conduct that is intended or has the actual effect of having a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of another. In this case, what the court determined about the objective reasonableness of the conduct, in this case, it was only talking about the emails. And it found that under this Peterson case, if you call the police in a good faith report about some safety issue or some crime, that should be protected, and we won't find it to be objectively unreasonable. In the Peterson case that the district court cited, the court said this. It said there is no evidence in the record that Johnson was motivated by a genuine concern, was not motivated rather by a genuine concern for his child's well-being.
So, Mr. Garrett, if I may, just so that I understand your position on this. So looking at that last part of the district court's decision, you would read the conduct was either considered objectively reasonable under the circumstances to go to the reports to probation and police. And then you would read or constitutes protected speech under the First Amendment to go to the social media post. Is that my understanding of what you're saying? Is that fair?
I did not understand the question, Your Honor.
So I'm just trying to once again go back to that sentence that you referred to. And I thought you were saying that when we look at when the district court was saying what's objectively reasonable under the circumstances, you're saying, oh, that just relates to the reports to police and probation. Is that fair?
That is what she's referring to in that sentence, yes.
And so that it's not referring to the social media posts. Those are that you're saying, believe the district court saying, hey, those are protected in the First Amendment and isn't looking to whether they're objectively reasonable. Is that fair?
That is fair. That was the analysis that this first set of incidents, the one about the reports to probation, et cetera, those were objectively reasonable. So we don't have to get to that. And that the other stuff, the second set of incidents regarding the social media posts and whatnot, that was simply protected free speech. Therefore, we can't hold Mr. Fishbeck accountable for that under this statute. That's a correct assessment of the analysis.
I ask counsel just as a follow up for that. When we look at the latter part, then the section 2B of the court's order, which is dealing with the social media posts, right? And the court concludes that they don't, that it doesn't, the conduct and says, let's see, respondents' actions do not rise to the level of conduct requiring this court to step in and curtail him, as was the case with Polinsky. So is what, if the First Amendment requires, in order to have the issuance of an HRO like this, that there be objectively unreasonable conduct in order to save it constitutionally, right? That's what the court was saying in Dunham. While it's an objective standard, that's what makes it a constitutional thing. Is the district court effectively saying this conduct, by not rising to the level of First Amendment protected speech, basically is saying this is the type of harassing conduct that, or this is not the type of harassing conduct that would warrant constitutionally or would justify an HRO constitutionally? Are they that sort of the same issue? It may not have been explained that way, but is that what the district court is essentially saying by considering that there is not that there is First Amendment protection? If there's First Amendment protection, it must not be objective, or it must be objectively reasonable.
No, I don't think that the court said that at all. The court simply relied on the fact that it was protected speech in the court's view, and therefore it is not actionable. It referred to the Polinsky case, of course, where there was something more than protected speech. And all these cases, as I point out, if it really is pure protected speech, then you need something more to go with it for it to be actionable under the statute. And that's where under Polinsky, the court was able to go in and issue an HRO restricting the conduct, even though it might otherwise have been protected speech. Here, the court says, oh, well, this is just protected speech and there's nothing else going on. Therefore, it's not actionable. The court was wrong about that, of course, because one, it's not protected speech. And two, I mean, it's factual analysis of why it's protected speech is erroneous. It concludes that it's protected speech merely because it, quote, is just public records or documents that are publicly available, which there is no rule that says if a document is publicly available, it's therefore protected. Mr. Fishbeck's post, his website that he built, Wells versus the World, was itself a publicly available document. If I take that and quote it, that doesn't mean that it becomes protected speech merely because someone published it.
Mr. Gertz, if I may, could you just be a little more specific for us? Which of the, I mean, and I've looked at all the social media posts and the blog posts, the district court looked at, which of those were not protected speech? Because a lot of them, as the district court pointed out, they're just like links to news articles or recapturing news articles. So could you help us be very specific here?
Well, his defamation, for example, is not protected. Well,
but this isn't a defamation lawsuit. And I read a lot about, you know, defamation law, but I mean, there's a difference between, but you're not claiming defamation here. You're talking about a harassment restraining order, which usually is something more about conduct directed at someone, not just saying something, even perhaps the wrong man, perhaps the untruthful things about someone.
Well, it's not a defamation lawsuit, but the language, because it is defamation, is not protected. And the court based its decision on the fact that it found it to be protected speech, which it is not. The speech was directed and intended to have, it's, this was not really in question. I mean, Mr. Fischbach said that he intended to invade the privacy of Mr. Wells by letting the entire world know about this, by letting his neighbors know that there, if they had children, they should be careful about him, by getting a posse to go out to do that, by contacting the local news media to run the story with the defamatory statements, NPR, the local news stations, everybody, and to make the thing go viral. It was certainly intended to have a substantial adverse effect on Mr. Wells' privacy.
Mr. Geertz, I mean, when I read that, taking as a whole, not in isolated pieces, I read this as a diatribe and anger about the Minnesota court system. You know, when you can imagine we were very, you know, hesitant to say, well, you know, look, there's a, you know, complaints about the court system, so we're going to say that's, you know, improper. I mean, people get to make those complaints, right?
Well, I disagree. This wasn't a there was some complaint about the Minnesota court system, no question about that. But the defamatory comments directed against Mr. Wells specifically had nothing to do with the Minnesota court system. They were an attack on Mr. Wells' integrity, and they were intended adversely to affect his privacy. And that's what the statute, that's why the statute is actionable in this case. They ended up having a substantial adverse effect on his security too, because he ended up being the subject of a great deal of vandalism at his home. And so you can complain about the court system, and I have no problem with that, and that would be protected speech. But the complaints or the defamation, directly against Mr. Wells is not a complaint about the court system, and it is not protected by the First Amendment.
Counsel, may I ask, is relative to the social media, I think your argument I'm hearing is that the district court erred as a matter of law in deciding it was not that it was protected speech, and that the district court did not make a determination about harassment because it mistakenly believed it was protected speech. Is that right?
That is accurate, yes.
So why on that, are you arguing, and maybe you are, but I thought in your brief you were asking that an HRO issue, wouldn't the relief instead be a remand, if we agreed with you, be a remand for the district court to decide whether it was in fact harassing?
I believe that is the appropriate relief, and I did ask for that. I added the section about why it constituted harassment, so the court would understand that this is actually a serious lawsuit, and the court should have got there and decided that issue. It did not get there and decide that issue on the basis of an incorrect legal analysis. Therefore, it abused its discretion. It should be sent back for an actual decision on whether harassment occurred, because as those last two final sentences point out, it didn't get to that issue. It one could conclude that this was reasonable behavior to try to interfere with the person's relationship with this probation officer. And that all the social media posts and everything, they were just protected by the First Amendment. Neither of those is true.
Well, that, you know, let me ask you this, Mr. Geertz, on the former, the contacts with the probation officer. I mean, the trial court heard testimony on that, from both parties here and made credibility determinations as to whether or not that was reasonable for Mr. Fishback to do. That's the trial court's prerogative to make those credibility determinations. So it seems to me that part of the argument here is asking us to reassess credibility, which is something we don't do.
It made no credibility determinations whatsoever, Your Honor. You will search the opinion high and low. You won't find that. What it did is it determined.
Well, didn't it implicitly believe the testimony of Mr. Fishback as to why he reported those matters to the probation office or law enforcement?
Your Honor, if it believed him, we have him on record expressly stating that his intent was Mr. Wells violated. Which is not a good faith report to the police about some safety concern. That was his intent. So if the court believed him, then it's not objectively reasonable conduct on his.
Well, isn't anytime someone reports something to a probation officer or a police officer that they're expecting them to take some action based upon the concerns they're reporting?
Nobody reports anything to a probation officer. And in this case, he had no reason to believe there was.
No, that's not the case. I've worked with probation officers for 35 years. They get direct reports from citizens all the time.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, there was no conduct that was unlawful to report and no conduct that a reasonable person would believe violated any of his conditions, because he had no reason to believe there was any reason for Mr. Wells not to send emails. There's nothing illegal about sending emails.
And yet, All right. Thank you, Mr. Gertz. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your time is up at this point. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge Flory. And for the record, I am Jerry Reams, counsel for the respondent, Jeff Fishback. And may it please the court. It seems that the court is very, very well geared into Minnesota statute section 609.748, which gives the standard for a finding of harassment in order to support a grant of a harassment restraining order. And it requires the appellant to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that Jeff Fishback, in this case, engaged in, quote, repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures that had a substantial effect, adverse effect on, or were intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the appellant's safety, security, or privacy. We also talked a little bit about the standards for the reasonability of the conduct and reasonability of the intent. This actually comes from a decision from this court from 2008 called Peterson v. Johnson. And you can find a pin site to that at page 764 of that opinion. And that decision decided that Minnesota's harassment statute requires both a showing of objectively unreasonable intent or conduct on the part of the harasser and an objectively reasonable belief on the part of the person subject to the harassment. The lower court cited this on the first page of their memorandum opinion in the second paragraph. And so that's where that language is coming from, because it isn't just these statutory requirements. It is also these other two requirements. And the court did focus largely on the objective reasonability of Fishback and the facts presented to it. But it was required to, under the decision by this court, that those are requirements to prove harassment under the statute. And at the evidentiary hearing in this matter, the appellant completely failed to meet his burden of establishing these things by a preponderance of the evidence. When asked repeatedly on the witness stand, he could not articulate how his safety, security, or privacy were adversely affected by anything Jeff Fishback had done, much less repeated acts.
Mr. Reams, if I may, but the district court doesn't appear to reach that issue in its memorandum. So how do we? I mean, is it?
I actually believe that they did. In fact, so I suppose we can start on the social media aspects of this. I think this is important because this First Amendment other side of the coin issue that we've been talking about comes into play. So the First Amendment, as we all know, broadly protects all speech, but there are limited exceptions to that. Defamation is one exception to that, but not the issue in this case, because it's not a defamation case, as you indicated, Judge Jetson. But harassment is another exception to the First Amendment. And so when the court finds that the First Amendment protects speech, the court is also finding that harassing conduct has not taken place. It's finding that because harassment is an exception to the First Amendment. And the court discusses that at length. In fact, it's probably the most discussed part of this opinion. The court discusses several instances where even posting publicly available documents might be considered harassment if it's done in a certain way. If you're directing a person or a group of people to go harm another person, or to do some action that does invade their security or privacy, that would still be harassment, even if it's under the guise of posting a publicly available document. But the court specifically found that that did not take place here. Here the court found that, unlike in the Polinsky case, where somebody did direct people to go contact the victim in that case, Fishbach's speech, quote, appears to be protected by all ordinary First Amendment rights because his conduct merely communicates readily available public information. And there's two parts to these posts, right? So you have the—
Mr. Remus, before you go further, I just want to clarify your position on our standard of review.
Sure.
I mean, first of all, would you agree that when the district court says, look, the conduct was objectively reasonable, that relates to the reports to probation and the police, and that is we should review under an abuse of discretion standard?
I believe, well, it's two parts because it's a mixed question, Your Honor. I believe the court's determination and fact-finding and weighing the credibility of Fishbach and the testimony, as well as the evidence presented to it, the court was permitted to perform a fact-finding and find that Fishbach had acted in a reasonable way. The court's discussion on these conversations being protected as a matter of public policy and the denial of the grant of the restraining order, I believe that would be reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard.
So I just want to make sure I understand your position, because you seem to be saying, look, that the court was saying that your client's conduct was objectively reasonable, and that includes both the reports to police and probation and the social media post. Is that your position?
Okay. That is my position.
So then you would say we look at all of that under an abuse of discretion. But wouldn't it be a fair reading of the district court's opinion to say, look, the district court was looking at the social media post not to ascertain whether there was objectively reasonable conduct, but whether it was protected under the First Amendment, and decided it was protected under the First Amendment, and we would review that arguably de novo. So could you let us know your perspective on that?
Sure. I don't believe that the court could possibly decide that the conduct at issue is protected under the First Amendment without also deciding that there was no harassing conduct at issue. Because if there were harassing conduct, it's clear from the court's analysis that none of this would be protected under the First Amendment. The court did its best to analyze similar cases where similar things happened. Other people posting news articles, but there's plus factors that went along with that. There was the at mention, where they're specifically targeting the victim. There's communications that specifically are intended to get people to invade somebody's privacy or harm them. And the court found that those just were not present here. In fact, the court found that there was no indication that Fishbach attempted to get anybody to attack or harm or contact the victim in this case. And without that indication, there can't be harassment under the case law that the judge court analyzed.
So, counsel, just to put a dot on this all, then that last sentence in the conclusion, or second to last sentence, respondent's conduct was either considered objectively reasonable under the circumstance or constitutes protected speech under the First Amendment may not precisely capture in your argument what the district court did, which is basically find that all of the conduct was objectively reasonable. And for that reason, some of it was protected by the First Amendment. The either or makes it a little bit perhaps subject to a different interpretation, but you're arguing, I think, that based on the findings above, the court found even the social media to be objectively reasonable conduct. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think the court wrote what it did. The court did not write either or, but not both. I believe we'd be reading that into the opinion unfairly. I believe this decision reads that every part of Fishbach's conduct at issue was objectively reasonable and therefore cannot be harassment under this court's decision in Peterson v. Johnson. But moreover, it was protected by the First Amendment. And again, I believe that those are two sides of the same coin, because something cannot be protected by the First Amendment if it's also harassing conduct. With respect to the evidence at issue, the appellant has argued that Fishbach admitted on the stand an intent to invade Wells' privacy. That's absolutely not true. That's nowhere in the transcript. And I would challenge the appellant to direct the court to that testimony. There was no intent on the part of Jeff Fishbach to direct anybody to go bother Wells. Even if his intent was to spread around this news story, that's also the goal of the news outlets. That's their goal, is to have everybody know the news. And nobody's alleging that the news outlets are guilty of harassment, and all he was doing was parroting what they were saying. He had commentary that went along with that, which the court also considered. The court holding, if you give me 1 second here. The court held that in the event that petitioner makes some argument that the way respondent characterizes this publicly available information on his website, social media, somehow paints Wells in a harsher light, this argument is also without merit. And she cited Polinsky for that rule. Under that case, Fishbach has a First Amendment right to comment on matters that relate to public issues. That is blog that may be an appropriate forum for exercising that right. And again, there's limitations to that because you cannot direct people to harm another individual or incite them to invade their privacy. But that's not what he did. I agree with your characterization, Judge Jessen, that most of his posts were related to the Minnesota court system. This has been a Kafka-esque experience for him, to say the least, in a court 2,000 miles away in a state he's only visited 5 times. When he's being, when a harassment restraining order is being sought against him by a man that he hasn't spoken with in 11 years. And this is the 5th case, not the 5th case plus appeal, but the 5th case, including an appeal, that Wells has brought against Fishbach over these past years.
Mr. Reams, if I may. So you, both of you, are pointing to the Polinsky case, as did the district court. That was an unpublished decision from this court. Should we be issuing a precedential opinion in this case? And if so, what would you say the syllabus point should be? And Mr. Gerrits, I hope you'll answer that question as well.
I do think that this court should draft a precedential opinion in this case, especially because we needed to rely so much on an unpublished opinion on, I think, a very important issue that really finds itself at the intersection of some very important interests for Americans, which is the right to publicly speak and the right to be free from harassment from other individuals, which are both crucially important. And I think the Polinsky decision provided the best analysis, and unfortunately it's published, in deciding whether or not commenting on public issues rises to the level of harassment. And here it shouldn't, because again, a person should be allowed to criticize the government. It should be allowed, a person should be allowed to criticize the court system. A person should be allowed to comment on the fact that they're being sued and to defend themselves without harassing another person, which is what happened here. And the court made its fact findings to that effect. As to the police reports, appellant argues that Fischbach was not justified in filing a police report for Wells violating his probation terms by sending emails and using the internet in violation of the conditions of his release. They argue that because the probation officer gets to decide whether or not he's in violation. Well, who did Fischbach talk to? The probation officer. Who would know better if Wells had permission to send these emails beyond the probation officer? He was absolutely reasonable in contacting this probation officer, who he only spoke with because he was encouraged to do so by another officer, Detective Stephanie Bolks of the Dakota County Police Department. It's also incorrect that the court failed to address every other issue, the threat that Wells made to him against his 11-year-old daughter. The court clearly says that Fischbach only contacted police after multiple troublesome contacts with Wells, and the court even says that its discussion of the emails is just one example of these contacts, and that's on page 3 of the decision. So if there's no other questions from the court, I will just say thank you for hearing our arguments today. I read this opinion as hearing all arguments, considering all evidence, and addressing all legal issues necessary to decide this issue. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Reams. Mr. Gertz, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, the respondent's characterization of the opinion, what the court found, we actually have separate subheadings. Subheading 2, the court referring to the multiple contacts with probation and so forth, said that was objectively reasonable. That was its conclusion there. The next section, it finds that the social media posts and whatnot are protected by the Constitution. So there's two, and that's what the court was referring to in its summary conclusion. It did not find, and certainly could not have found, that the social media posts and building the websites and whatnot was objectively reasonable conduct. So that is not where it went. And it erred in deciding that the speech was protected. It just took at face value that, if you can find it someplace publicly, it's protected. Well, that's not the standard. In this case, there clearly is defamation, and defamation is not protected speech. So it errs when it finds that there's protected speech. And doesn't actually get to the issue of whether harassment occurred.
So, counsel, when I look at that concluding paragraph, like very closely, like you're doing, it opens with that the first element, objectively unreasonable intent or conduct, it says was not established. It says petitioner failed to establish an adequate factual basis on the first of these two required elements. In other words, it failed to establish objectively unreasonable conduct. And then why did it fail to do that? It says it was either considered objectively reasonable under circumstance or constitutes protected speech under the First Amendment. So it does strike me that when it says the first element was not satisfied with respect to all of this conduct, it has said with respect to all of this conduct that there's a failure to show objectively unreasonable conduct.
Well, what it does, Your Honor, with respect to the speech, is it says it's protected speech. Therefore, there's nothing objectively unreasonable about it, and we don't get to go there. But that was an error of law. It was not protected speech. When you accuse people of crimes that they did not commit, such as soliciting the receipt of child pornography, a serious felony, that is defamation. When you accuse a person of being a twice convicted pedophile, when the person speaking is on notice that that's absolutely false, then that's not protected speech. It's defamation. So it didn't actually get beyond that point in the opinion. If you want to say that, it found that speaking in a protected way under the Constitution is not unreasonable, I'll go with you that far. But it based its decision in the second part on the fact that this speech was all protected, which is simply not true. Counsel's comments about Polinsky is not, there are plenty of cases that say exactly what Polinsky does, not from the state of Minnesota. But what they say is that if you have protected speech, there has to be something more than the protected speech for it to constitute harassment. And in Polinsky, they talk about that. Well, there was something more here. There was conduct that was intended to reach the victim. And that's all Polinsky really says. And there are, I cite in my reply brief, other cases that say the same thing. Those are like the telephone harassment cases where it's just speech that someone's talking when they call you up and try and sell you something. But the fact that they are entering your home through the telephone, that is conduct in addition to the speech that renders it actionable. Polinsky doesn't really add any more to that equation. And that only applies in cases where you have protected speech. If you have just an ordinary case, all the statute requires is an intent on the part of the actor to have a substantial adverse effect on the privacy of another person. It's all that's required. You don't actually have to be successful. So I see my time is up. Unless there's a question, I thank you for your time.
All right, thank you, Mr. Gertz and Mr. Reams, for your briefing and arguments in the matter. It was helpful to the court, and we will now take the matter under advisement, and we will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe. We stand adjourned on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.